Welcome to the January 20th service of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Blacksburg, Virginia. The service today is led by our settled minister, Reverend Pam Phillips, and the title of her sermon is Infinite Hope.
If you're following along in your order of service, someone should be reading a reflection written by Aisha and Sano right now, but I'd rather save that till the end. Our opening words this morning say that we have come into this room of song, where we unite our voices in the somber and beautiful melodies of life. So I'd like to consider the songs we're singing together and how we unite our voices. There is more love somewhere. It is such a plaintive song, a song that some Unitarian Universalists have a hard time singing the way it's written. I've been in services and gatherings where we've sung it not mournfully, but joyfully, by changing the end of each line to right here. There is more love right here. Am I the only one? Have you ever sung it that way? Yeah. It came from a good place, from a feeling of gratitude that we had found more love, more hope, more peace, more joy in the beloved community that Unitarian Universalism represents to us. But it also came from a place of privilege. Reverend Peter C. Bulotta speaks to this in a blog about the unsettling practice of UU's changing the words we sing to fit our experience of the world instead of that of the original singers. In this case, African Americans. Of this particular hymn, he writes, "People who have everything they need don't understand why they would sing about love and hope and joy being somewhere else. People privileged enough to not want for many of life's blessings can be incapable of hearing the yearning of those who go without." But this is an African American hymn that speaks to the experience of the world that is filled with disappointment, an experience of slavery and oppression. This is a song of lamentation, but also of determination. There is more love, not here, but somewhere. And each verse ends with the infinite hope that we can keep on till we find it. As Bulotta puts it, this song is among that repertoire of African American songs from the time of slavery. Spirituals give voice to the experience of slavery, the African American experience of survival and resilience. These songs give theological voice, he writes, to those who endured slavery, making meaning and spurring resistance as they are sung. As did the song that you all sang for us this morning. It's important, especially on days like today, Martin Luther King Sunday, that we honor the experience of survival and resilience, the meaning making and resistance spurring that this song represents. Honor it, appreciate it, and try to understand it. To sing the original words of the hymn with appreciation for what they might mean to people whose experience of the world is very different from our own. Today's sermon was inspired by the quote on the top of your order of service, words of Martin Luther King Jr. from a sermon he gave in 1963. I'll read them for you. "We must accept finite disappointment, but never lose infinite hope." It took me a while to find the sermon where he wrote it. The internet is full of wrong cues. He was writing about Paul sitting in a cell in Rome instead of going to Spain to preach the gospel. It's a good sermon. And if I had any guts, I would just get up and read it to you. His words, though, the part that I remember too, I was struck by was, we must accept finite disappointment, but cling to infinite hope. Lots of variations. It's cling. And when I look back on the description of the service I wrote for today, I realized that I asked a question that I have no possible way of answering. Because we're considering what it means to be a people of possibility, I asked this question: what are the possibilities of achieving Reverend Dr. King's dream of racial equity? Really, I thought I could answer that question. What are the possibilities of achieving racial equity? Now, a few years ago, I might have had an easier time answering that question. I'm going to get emotional again. Sorry. Get ready. I will never forget the night I watched our country elect our first African-American president. This is what I was doing that night. My sister was living in Libya at the time, and she was doing the exact same thing as me. We wept. It was almost surreal. The next day at school, I taught middle school, one of my students showed me a newspaper clipping that he had already laminated as a keepsake. He and his father had gone out in search of a newspaper so that they would have a record of what had happened. Now, not thinking that he had the perspective to understand how historic this event was, I started to teach him, saying, "You don't know how amazing, how important this is." And his reply caught me up short. He said, "Miss Phillips, it'll be a minute. I can see his face. You don't know how important this is for someone who looks like me." I was schooled by a seventh grader. I'll never forget him and the look on his face and the hope that a black president must have meant to him as a young black boy. Back then, I might have answered the question about the possibility of achieving King's dream with an enthusiastic, "Yes, we can." I know that sounds amazingly naive now. Now, don't get me wrong, I did not subscribe to the belief that we had achieved a post-racial society. I knew that there would still be hard work to do, that I would have a lot more to learn about my own white privilege. But I sure did feel hopeful. The impossible became possible, and it felt amazing. The night of Obama's election reminded me of the day I heard that Nelson Mandela had been released from his South African prison cell. Do you remember that day? Wasn't that amazing? Even so far away, I knew how monumental that day was. The efforts of so many people around the world to end apartheid through divesting in South African companies and boycotting events held in South Africa had made a difference. And then only 4 years later, he was president of South Africa. The impossible became possible. And of course, it hasn't magically ended all the problems in South Africa. But the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was a good step in moving them forward. The past few years, though, have made us all much less naive, much less optimistic. The shooting of unarmed black men and boys has made us less hopeful. It started in 2012 when 17-year-old Trayvon Martin was shot while walking through a neighborhood, wearing a hoodie and carrying Skittles, and his killer went free. And then came the ever-growing list of unarmed black men and boys killed by police officers. Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, Eric Harris, Walter Scott, Philando Castile, Freddie Gray, Sam DuBose. And these are only the high-profile cases, ones which we saw replayed on our television screens because of that cell phone video footage. And in most of these cases, the police were not held accountable for the deaths, setting off protests like the ones in Ferguson, Missouri. But you may have seen the news from Chicago, a police officer going to jail for shooting he was armed and walking away. I've seen that video over and over again. And then there are those cases of living while black that we've been hearing so much about. When white people call 911 when they feel nervous or threatened by black people who are simply living their lives. A black child who mowed the wrong part of a yard. A black family eating at Subway. An 8-year-old girl selling bottled water. A woman using the private pool in her gated community. A trio of filmmakers staying in an Airbnb. Or a group of black women on a golf course. There are so many more stories, ones that never make the evening news or our Facebook feeds. What are the possibilities of achieving racial equity? It's not sounding very good, is it? And yet, I'm reminded of a conversation at a UU minister's retreat shortly after the most recent presidential election. As you might imagine, the mood was somber. We're a bunch of bleeding heart liberals, for the most part. And several people expressed fear and frustration, worried about what the next administration might do. And the few black ministers in the room just shook their heads and went tsk, tsk. For them, nothing had changed. Nothing would change. It was the same old, same old. We were being schooled by our colleagues. What they'd been trying to tell us for years was finally making sense. Some of us had a felt sense of the kind of despair and disappointment and distrust they'd been feeling their whole lives. We were starting to get it, to wake up. Peter Boulata, in his blog about our meditation hymn, asked the question, are white Unitarian Universalists not capable of identifying with black experience? Not willing, perhaps, to imagine the context out of which this song originated? Are white Unitarian Universalists not capable of identifying with black experience? Not capable or not willing to identify with people of color. Isn't it time that we, mostly white Unitarian Universalists, become more willing and able to identify with people of color? To watch the videos and to listen to the voices of those who are being harmed and to believe them. To sing the songs with the original words, the original intent, and take strength and resolve from them. Because if we are to maintain infinite hope in the face of disappointment, it's important to acknowledge, to understand, to lament those disappointments. Maybe especially the disappointment we feel in ourselves. Several years ago, one of my teaching pastors suggested that I memorize the words to our closing hymn. She said that I would want to sing it on days like today, and that it would be important to the African Americans in the room that I had taken the trouble to learn and know those words. More recently, I read somewhere that we who identify as white shouldn't sing this song because it doesn't mean the same to us as it does to black people. I wish I'd memorized the songs this fall at the NAACP fundraiser dinner. Last year, they had the words in the order in the program, but not this year. And yet, most of the people around me knew all the words to all the verses by heart. How many of you know all the words to all the verses of the Star Spangled Banner? Jim. Lift Every Voice and Sing was written by James Weldon Johnson as a poem, which was set to music by his brother, John Rosamond Johnson. Now, James wrote the poem when he was a principal of a school, and the song was first performed on February 12th, 1900, in honor of Abraham Lincoln's birthday. It was sung by 500 children in a black school. Can you imagine what that would have sounded like? The song was adopted by the NAACP as its official song, and it was said to be Martin Luther King Jr.'s favorite hymn. Lift Every Voice and Sing is referred to as the Black National Anthem. I feel like I read somewhere that someone wants that to be the song sung at some sporting events. Do you remember which one it was, Stephen? No. That would be something, wouldn't it? This afternoon, the local NAACP chapter is holding a service at 3 o'clock at the Schaefer Memorial Baptist Church in Christiansburg, and I'm pretty sure we'll be singing this song. I hope some of you will be able to attend it, or any of the many other events being held in the weeks ahead. Because if we are to become more willing and able to identify with and understand our black neighbors' experience of the world, we need to join with them in other spaces to listen to their stories and celebrations. Next Saturday, the Dialogue on Race is holding its winter summit at the Christiansburg Middle School. Think about attending. If we are to have infinite hope in the face of finite disappointment, then it is important for us to learn the Black National Anthem and to sing it with an appreciation of the experience out of which it comes. To that end, I would like to share the reflection that's promised in your order of service. It's written by Aisha Ansano, a Unitarian Universalist minister serving one of our congregations in Massachusetts. I thought maybe it would be better to hear someone else's words, not mine. She is a black Unitarian Universalist minister. And these are her words. Martin Luther King Jr. Day is a time when particular songs get sung. One of them is Lift Every Voice and Sing. It gets sung in school, in church, and at various MLK Day celebrations, or over the course of Black History Month. It is a very, very powerful song, but it's often sung without context. And at times, it's sung without a lot of intentionality. When you sing Lift Every Voice and Sing, do you pay close attention to the words? It's easy on a Sunday morning to open the hymnal and sing along without necessarily processing what we're saying, what the words we're saying really mean. Sing a song full of the faith that the dark past has taught us. Bitter, the chastening rod felt in the days when hope unborn had died. We have come over a way that with tears has been watered. We have come treading our path through the blood of the slaughtered. This song, she writes, deserves to be sung with attention. It is a song that starkly names the horrors and violence of racism in this country. And it is a song that should make us uncomfortable. Uncomfortable with the history that it calls upon. Uncomfortable with the fact that the struggle for racial justice continues and has not come quite so far as it should have by now. How can anyone sing the words, "treading our path through the blood of the slaughtered," without a deep, deep discomfort? So when we sing this song, she writes, will you join me in singing with intentionality? Will you join me in the deep discomfort that I will be feeling in singing those words? Discomfort with the pain and horror that those words refer back to. And discomfort with the fact that those words do not only refer to a distant history, but also to what is happening now. Will you commit to sitting with your own discomfort? And then will you tap into that discomfort and do something? Will you lift your voice and sing until earth and heaven ring with the harmonies of liberty? So endeth the reading.